On Tuesday, a district in Wisconsin holds its second in-person election in the midst of a pandemic. This is The Morning Show. I'm Keeley Boltina in for Kate Archer-Kent. And we're talking about the 7th Congressional District. U.S. Congressman Sean Duffy stepped down from the seat in the fall. Now voters decide who to send to Washington, Tom Tiffany or Tricia Zunker. And they're making that decision by mail and in person, despite a current stay-at-home order across Wisconsin due to COVID-19. We're talking about the safety of this election and how clerks are handling different aspects of it. So what's on your mind? 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about the May 12th special election? How are you voting on Tuesday? Are you casting an absentee ballot or are you going to the polls? Tell us if you're a poll worker or a volunteer. 800-642-1234. Our guest is Tracy Hartman, the Oneida County Clerk who was elected in 2016. She's also the clerk for the town of Crescent. Tracy, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you.
Governor Evers' stay-at-home order as it currently stands doesn't run out until May 26th, but the race for the 7th Congressional District seat is on for Tuesday. With that in mind, what are you expecting turnout-wise on Tuesday?
So we're anticipating a good turnout for the election as a whole. We've had a very good turnout for absentee ballots, and so we're anticipating that Tuesday in person may not be quite as high as it would have been, but with those absentee ballots and then the in-person that does turn out, we're expecting a nice turnout on Tuesday.
Do you have a number on absentee ballots so far?
Yeah, so in Oneida County so far, our municipalities have sent out around 8,500 absentee ballots for the May election.
Okay, and then the deadline to request them, though, that has passed.
The deadline to request that an absentee ballot get mailed to you was 5 p.m. last night. So, yes, so residents can no longer request that they get mailed. Some municipal clerks will still be handling in-person absentee voting today. So if somebody is realizing they missed their opportunity to vote absentee, they should contact their town clerk today to see if that town clerk is also doing in-person voting today.
And we're going to hearken back to our April elections quite a few times, I think, in our conversation. But one of the things that was challenging with that was kind of back and forth about when absentee ballots had to be turned in or in the mail or in person. So how does that work? When does your ballot need to be to the clerk to be counted in this election?
In this election, there were no changes made to state law. So ballots need to be back to your clerk by Tuesday, May 12th, in order to be counted in the May election.
Okay, so drop them in the mail right away, or you can hand deliver them?
You can hand deliver them, absolutely. In fact, you know, at the April election, I know out in Crescent, we had people dropping their absentee ballots off all day so that they didn't have to come into the polls. They would meet one of our workers outside. So that's definitely an option, or meet up with your town clerk, schedule a time to meet with them and drop your ballot with them. But definitely if you're going to mail it, you want to put it in the mail as soon as possible.
And because those are absentee ballots, could I take the three voters in my family and turn all of them in, or does it have to be the person who is on the ballot turning it in to the elections officials?
Nope. Anybody can turn in the absentee ballot. As long as they're sealed and they're in the envelope and certified, then anybody can bring them in. So, yes, one person could bring in multiple ballots from their household.
Okay. We're talking about Tuesday's special election with Oneida County Clerk Tracy Hartman. Voters across northern Wisconsin are picking a new representative in Congress, and we want to hear from you. What do you think about how this election is being handled? How would you feel safest going to the polls when we do have COVID-19 spreading? How do you think Wisconsin should handle future elections as this pandemic continues? 800-642-1234. There's a line for you there, or you can email ideas@wpr.org. And let's talk a little bit more about voting absentee. In Wisconsin, what do you need to qualify to vote absentee? Do you have to have a specific reason?
You do not. In Wisconsin, you can vote absentee for any reason. So really the qualifications are that you're a registered voter and that you provide your municipal clerk with a copy of your photo ID. And you only have to provide the photo ID one time. They will keep that on file then. And for future elections, you'll just need to submit a written request. And that's pretty much the list of things that you need to do to get an absentee ballot.
And what about before we turn those absentee ballots in for that April 7th election? We had some confusion over whether people needed to have a witness signature for their ballot to be counted. Is that a requirement here?
That is a requirement, yes. So when a voter gets an absentee ballot, they're going to get the ballot from their clerk, and they're going to get a special envelope. It's called a certificate envelope. They need to complete their ballot, put it in the envelope, and then they will sign it, and they need to have somebody who is over the age of 18 also sign that. It does not need to be somebody who lives in that municipality. It can be anybody, but somebody over the age of 18 needs to sign it and give their address in order for that ballot to be counted.
What about people who live alone or are trying to, you know, make sure they keep their physical distance? How can they get a signature from a witness?
Yeah, that does make it a little bit trickier, but there are some recommendations out there, and one of them is that, you know, if a voter has somebody that can come to their home, that witness can watch them fill out their ballot through a window, sign it, and then the voter can put the ballot outside. The witness can grab it, sign it, and either leave it for the voter to put back in the mail, or the witness can put it in the mail for them. That way they're not having contact with the person, but they are having a witness sign it.
Sure, not side by side. How are you doing with poll workers? The pandemic led to a shortage of them during the April 7th election. Is Oneida County experiencing that this time around?
We are seeing it a little bit. We have not seen it as much yet as in April. However, in April, some of the issues weren't made known until the day before the election. But we do have three municipalities that have asked for help with poll workers in Oneida County. One, a small municipality, lost two of her three poll workers. And then the city of Rhinelander has asked for some help, and then another town in Oneida County. And the National Guard is, again, providing some National Guard members to come help, and so we have some that will be arriving Monday, checking in with me, and then they'll be assigned to polls throughout the county.
We've seen in Racine, Milwaukee, and Superior, they've all decided to automatically send their voters' absentee applications by mail ahead of the next election. That's the big presidential race in the fall. Would that work for Oneida County? Is that something you're considering?
That is not something we have looked at yet. However, because we still have the May election coming up, we're focusing on that, and we haven't started to look towards how to change up the absentee process for the fall elections. I know some county clerks are doing that, and it's definitely something that we'll be looking at after May is done.
Gotcha. So first things first, you've got a special election to run on Tuesday.
We do, yes. We had to close out April, and we have a May election, so the last month, that's what we've been dealing with, and we'll start dealing with the fall after this one.
Yeah, I think a lot of people are moving one step at a time right now, so that probably sounds pretty familiar. Though on sending things out, how much does it cost to send absentee ballots out or those applications for absentee ballots for the county or for any municipalities?
Yeah. So absentee ballots are all handled through the municipality, so it's a cost. It's on the burden of the town, and it is $1.10, two stamps, one stamp to send it, and then the towns are responsible to put a stamp on the certificate envelope. So for every voter that requests one, it's $1.10 for postage. I should say there's additional costs, of course. It's special envelopes that they have to send them in, so they have to purchase those, and then their time. But it's just over $1.10 to send them out.
All right. Tracy Hartman is the Oneida County Clerk, and we are talking about the safety of Tuesday's election in the 7th Congressional District. Voters there are electing Wisconsin's next representative in D.C. We've gone over some of the mechanics of the race, and now we're going to focus in a little bit more on safety at the polls and tallying the results. And there's room for you in this conversation. Are you voting on Tuesday? Have you chosen to use an absentee ballot, or are you going to the polls? What do you think about this election happening right now? And how do you want to make sure that people stay safe? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. Our conversation continues here on The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina, and this is The Ideas Network. Tricia Zunker and Tom Tiffany are vying to be Wisconsin's next member of Congress. They face off in Tuesday's special election for the 7th Congressional District. That used to be Sean Duffy's seat before he resigned late last year. And if people aren't requesting an absentee ballot or still want to vote in the election, they can show up at the polls in person next week. It's The Morning Show. I'm Keeley Boltina. We're talking about how elections officials are handling this vote as COVID-19 threatens the health and safety of people, especially when we gather in groups. And you're part of this conversation. There's a line for you at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the way that Wisconsin is handling elections right now under a stay-at-home order? Do you think that changes when the order is lifted, even though COVID-19 is not going away? Maybe you live in the 7th Congressional District. Help us understand how your community is handling Tuesday's election. 800-642-1234. Oneida County Clerk Tracy Hartman is our guest. And Matt from Wausau sent us an email. He says having yet another in-person election is not just a bad idea, it's a deadly one. We're the only state still having dangerous, unnecessary in-person elections. And I'm not sure if any other states have opened back up for elections, Tracy, but Matt's point is this is a public health issue. How do you respond to him?
Yeah. So I agree, and the clerks in the in our district are taking their safety of the voters extremely seriously. There were major changes made in the April election to how polling locations are set up and how people are coming in to vote, and those changes will be implemented again in May. You know, many clerks implemented limits to the number of voters that would be allowed into a polling location, so the lines were outside where they could spread out more. Many towns had partitions built so that they were not having face-to-face contact with their poll workers, so that there was separation there. And within the polling location, you know, lines were taped so that voters did not sit or stand closer than 6 feet to each other. Many polling locations had a greeter at the door sanitizing voters' hands and had individual pens for voters so that they were not sharing, you know, writing utensils. They were using their own pen and taking it home with them. So we take it very seriously, but it is an election that we do not have a say in whether it occurs or not. So we're going to make it the best that we can.
And you mentioned all of those precautions that were put into place in April. Are you following those again on Tuesday?
So the town clerks in Oneida County that I've spoken with, yes, they all plan to implement the same. Some have added additional precautions after the April election. They saw some areas that there were some concerns. So we took April. We learned from it. We've improved upon it. And I think overall, at least in Oneida County, it was a positive experience, and we kept the voters as safe as possible.
Yeah. What are you changing this time around?
You know, so I've heard there's a couple towns that did not have the partitions between their poll workers during April. They just didn't have time to get those, and they've added those. A couple of clerks found that they had too many people in the town hall. They thought they could have a few more, and they were getting too crowded, so they're going to limit that a little bit more this time. You know, so they're tweaking what they did. They're tweaking it a little bit to make it even better.
How concerned are you about this being a public health risk? Just looking at data from the state health department, Oneida County has far fewer confirmed cases, really only a handful compared to other more populated parts of the state.
Yeah. You know, we are seeing fewer cases up here, in large part because our residents have taken very seriously the safer at home, the not meeting in groups, you know, staying further apart. And so we're going to implement that in our elections. It's obviously always a concern, you know, but even in April with, I believe it was almost 400,000 people statewide that went out to vote, they have only been able to tie 54 cases. And not to minimize that, but that's an extremely low percentage. And up here, since we have even fewer cases of it, we're feeling as comfortable as we can that this election is going to go on.
How many polling places will be open in the county?
In Oneida County, we will have 22 polling locations.
And is that a typical number for you, or have you had to close some because of a shortage, or have you opened up more?
So we've only had to close one polling location in Oneida County. The city of Rhinelander usually has two, and they've condensed it into one. However, they've moved their polling location to the gymnasium at the high school, so it's an extremely large area that they're able to spread out. So size-wise, it's equitable to what they're normally in.
And probably a decent reminder to check before you go to the polling place if you're going to be voting in person, just as an extra precaution to make sure you know where you're headed.
Absolutely. Yes. Most of the polling locations, well, all but those two have remained the same, but it does not hurt to check your polling location to make certain that you know where you're going. I would tell voters if you're concerned about being around other people, you know, most polling locations from 7 until 9:30 in the morning, that's a busy time. Again, over lunchtime is busy, and then right after work is busy. So if you're hoping to get there when it's a little bit quieter, between 10 and noon and 2 and 4, and then after 6:30 is usually a pretty quiet time at the polls.
We are talking about Tuesday's special election with Oneida County Clerk Tracy Hartman. Voters across northern Wisconsin are picking a new representative in Congress, and we are talking about how the election is working and how election officials and volunteers are trying to keep everybody safe, because we do know that COVID-19 continues to spread. Tracy, last month's election had clerks tallying votes a week after the election was held, almost a week. When will we see results from this election?
This election, we will see results election night. So the polls close at 8 p.m., and clerks will be starting to tally their results and calling them in. Many towns, the machines, you know, tally it for them, and they'll be calling results in pretty quickly after 8 o'clock. So by the end of Wednesday night, we definitely should have some unofficial results. The official results are not known until the canvass can occur, which doesn't happen at the state level until about a week and a half to 2 weeks after the election. But by Tuesday night, we'll definitely start seeing some indications of how that election went.
All right. And we do have Don from Madison who is ready to talk with us. Thanks for calling, Don.
Good morning. I got a question about the a new process called Real ID. I don't know much about it, and I'm curious about whether the folks in the upcoming election that you're describing this morning have to cope with it, or if they'll have to cope with it sometime in the general election in November.
Okay, thanks for the question, Don. Real ID, these are higher standards to get a specific kind of identification card, right? Or a specific kind of license. Tracy?
Correct. Yeah, so Real ID has to do with your driver's license. In the state of Wisconsin, you do have to have a photo ID to vote, but it does not specify that it has to be Real ID compliant. You know, so there's a list of photo IDs that you can use for it. One of them is your driver's license, but as long as your driver's license was not expired at the last general election in 2018, your photo ID will be compliant for voting purposes. So Real ID is not needed to vote.
All right. That's excellent to know. And it also appears that Real ID deadlines have been delayed until next year, so you don't have to worry too much about that right now, Don. But thanks for the interesting call. I hope that answers your question. As Oneida County's clerk and the clerk for the town of Crescent, Tracy, what is the big takeaway from those elections almost a month ago? And how is that informing how you're administering what happens on Tuesday?
Yeah, I think the big takeaway was that, you know, we saw a big turnout for absentee, and that's a great way for people to vote. Unfortunately, like we've already said, they've missed some of their ability to do that for this one. So, you know, be prepared to go to the polls, be prepared to wait so that we can limit the number of people that are in the polling location. And the poll workers are just going to make sure they take their time, that we're not rushing people through. We want the election to be run correctly and accurately. So we're going to take our time. We're going to make sure it's run correctly. And people are going to have to possibly wait so we can keep them spread out a little bit more.
All right. So poll workers have responsibilities. What do you recommend people who are voting do so that they are following safety recommendations and they're keeping people safe if they show up to the polls on May 12th?
Yeah. So people, you know, when you show up at the polls, you are aware of who's around you. So make sure you're keeping your distance. Obviously, if you have a mask, we would encourage you to wear a mask. The poll workers will if they're not behind a partition, will hopefully be wearing masks. They can make sure that, you know, the voter can make sure they're sanitizing their hands both before and when they leave. Most polls should have some sort of sanitizing spray there, so feel free to use it or have somebody else spray your hands so that, you know, you've kept yourself as clean as possible. And when you're in the polling location, if your poll doesn't have lines of 6 feet apart, you know, just be aware of that and keep your distance from other people.
All right, Tracy, thank you so much for your time today.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Tracy Hartman is the Oneida County Clerk who was elected in 2016. She's also the clerk for the town of Crescent, and we've been talking about the 7th Congressional District special election, which happens on Tuesday. Up next is news. Then we explore the lessons learned from fighting polio as scientists seek a vaccine for the new coronavirus. Thanks again to listeners for this segment idea during last week's show, where you told us what you want to hear on the morning show. And just a quick mention that as the effects of COVID-19 grow in Wisconsin, WPR has the latest developments from reporters around the state, and you can submit your questions about COVID-19, and we'll do our best to answer them. Just go to WPR.org/COVID. I'm Keeley Boltina. It's The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network. We are looking to the past for insights into the future. Scientists around the world are trying to understand how this new coronavirus works and what we can use to make it less deadly or even prevent people from getting sick in the first place. And we find ourselves thinking about epidemics of the past. That includes polio. No one knew how people got it. Kids were paralyzed and died, finally after decades, a vaccine. It's The Morning Show. I'm Keeley Boltina in for Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking about what it took to stop polio from being a constant looming threat to our health. And we want to hear from you. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Do you remember a time before the polio vaccine was developed and available? Did you or your friends get polio? Did you know someone in your family who experienced it? Share your story with us. Help us understand that context at 800-642-1234. Our guest is Dr. Gareth Williams. He's an emeritus professor of medicine at the University of Bristol. He's written or co-authored more than 20 books, including Paralyzed with Fear, The Story of Polio. Dr. Williams, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
We saw polio epidemics spring up around the world starting in the 1890s. People were paralyzed, people died, and that vaccine didn't become available until 1954. What was it like when polio was at its peak in the 40s and 50s before we got this vaccine to people?
It was pretty horrendous. It was an annual curse. The polio season used to come around in late spring, early summer. And some countries, particularly the U.S., in fact, were literally paralyzed with fear at the threat of this thing dropping out of the sky again. In fact, you have to wind back to 1916 to discover why polio exerted such a grip on populations around the world. 1916 was the year of the great polio epidemic on the east coast of the U.S., and it hit particularly hard New York State, New York City. And in the city, it left about 10,000 people paralyzed and 2,500 people dead. And this was just in the months between July and December. And the thing that really left the scars, pretty indelible scars, really, on the American psyche and lots of other populations around the world, was that whatever the doctors and the experts and the public health people tried to do to stop this epidemic, all the measures failed. So they tried everything. They tried getting rid of flies. They tried scrubbing the sidewalks clean, millions of gallons of water a day. They shot tens of thousands of cats because they thought cats might be transmitting it. They declared war on flies. They did everything, and everything that they did basically failed. So at the end of this... Go on, sorry. Yeah.
I wanted to touch on that because the one of the problems was that people didn't understand how it was spreading, so it was hard to combat it.
That's exactly right. They knew by then that it was a virus, but they had no idea what sort of a virus it was. And very little was known about viruses then anyway. So that it was smaller than a bacterium. That was basically all that they knew. And they had no idea how it was spread. There was a theory from important people in the Rockefeller Institute in New York that the virus got into the nose and then traveled up the nerves, at the smell nerves, if you like, at the top of the nose into the brain, and that's how the virus got in. In fact, we know now that it was spread by what's indelicately known as the fecal-oral route, so basically in heading south from the teeth and down through the gut. But back then, they had no idea, and that, as you say, really constrained them in what they were trying to do to stamp the outbreak out.
Was social distancing something that people tried during the polio epidemics? I mean, that's certainly what we're working to do right now with the new coronavirus.
Well, it was actually worse than that, because if somebody got polio during that first big outbreak, then the whole of the family was shut in the house unless the patient was at death's door. If there were more than a couple of houses affected in a street, then the whole street was locked down, a complete no-go zone. And in the end, there were whole districts in New York that were just boarded up and shut off. And again, because they thought flies might be transmitting polio, there were instructions to use fly screens and bolt the windows shut. And it was a very long, hot summer, so it must have been hell on earth.
Certainly. And if you weren't allowed to leave your section of houses, it would be nearly impossible to distance socially. I understand, though, that people who had money had more of an opportunity to try to keep away from polio as far as social distancing goes, right? Because many of them could leave or travel.
Well, they did. Even during that first outbreak, they were able to get permits for children to leave the city. So about 1,000 kids a day were leaving during the late summer. They had to get permits from doctors to say that they were free from the disease. But the trouble with polio, as it appears to be with coronavirus, is that you can look relatively well. You don't certainly have to be paralyzed. Only a few percent of people actually got clinical paralysis. So you could be walking around feeling in pretty good shape. So the doctor would say you're free from disease, but actually you were infected, which meant that you would then carry the infection out of the lockdown zone into wherever you were going. And as you imply, later on after that, at the start of the polio season each year, people would flee the cities. They'd go down to the coast or they'd go up into the mountains in the belief that they'd be able to stay away from polio. But it's one of those illnesses that just had a habit of seeking people out wherever they went.
There are some ideas about the fact that perhaps the new coronavirus will wane during the summer and come back. We see that with influenza. Is that what happened with polio? Why was it worse in the summertime?
Well, they never sorted out the full epidemiology of polio and its seasonal variation. But the fact was that it tended to reappear in late spring, and epidemics would generally die out through the late autumn into the winter. Although some, including the New York one of 1916, actually carried on until the early months of 1917. So it was a seasonal illness. And again, we still never really got to the bottom of why that was. But it had a very pronounced seasonal pattern to it, yeah.
Dr. Gareth Williams is the author of Paralyzed with Fear, The Story of Polio. And we're talking about how the polio epidemics happened and the lessons that we can learn from them. And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. You can also send us an email to ideas@WPR.org. And Craig from Sturgeon Bay is on the line now to talk with us. Hi, Craig.
Hi. I had a comment that has more to do with how the scarce vaccine at the time was distributed. And the comment is that the way it was distributed could be a model for how the scarce personal protective gear could be distributed today. And it also includes ventilators and so on. And that is, as I understand it, the U.S. Public Health Service was the central point of contact for the 40 different pharmaceutical labs that had contracts. And they procured it, and then also then were the ones in charge of getting that to the different state departments of public health, who then distributed through the schools. And it was the physician coordinators in each state who then had to keep the contact back with the Department of Public Health.
Yeah, Craig, let's get back to Dr. Gareth Williams quick to find out, is that how we made sure that people got the vaccine right away? And could we deploy that kind of strategy again with other things?
Well, Craig's absolutely right. That was the initial strategy. In fact, when the first clinical trials were done with the Salk vaccine in the early 50s, the bottom line was that it works and it's safe. And instantly, mass vaccination was rushed in for all the kids across the US. And the problem was that one of those 40 vaccine companies that Craig mentions was actually a bit of a cowboy outfit. They're based outside Berkeley in California, and their health and safety regulations were hopeless. And they managed to contaminate a batch of the vaccine. This was a killed poliovirus vaccine. They managed to contaminate a whole batch with live virulent poliovirus. So that meant that there was an outbreak of paralytic polio in some of the vaccinated kids. Not only killed and paralyzed them, but did the same to some of their parents. So this was a huge PR catastrophe just after the launch. So Craig's right, that was the strategy. And indeed, that was carried on further with the elimination of the rogue outfit, if you like, that had produced the dangerous batch. And that's, again, how that is going to factor into the model for distributing the coronavirus vaccine when eventually it comes through, I really do not know. I hope that it's going to be a multinational effort, because this is a global plague that we're all confronting. And this is not a time to play sort of national or state level politics. In the UK, we have a similar sort of dilemma at the minute with the four nations all doing slightly different things. But at least I think that if we get a vaccine that works, it will be distributed equitably.
Craig, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234 to share your perspective as we are talking about polio. And there is a line for you at 800-642-1234. Share your story. Help us understand what polio looked like for your family. If you heard stories about people being concerned, or if you experienced it in the 40s and 50s, give us a call at 800-642-1234. And Dr. Williams, it seems like there is some sort of similarity between polio and the new coronavirus, especially in the fact that it just kind of suddenly appeared, right? How did we get polio? It just happened.
Well, that's a really good point. And the more the coronavirus story goes on, the more I'm reminded of the parallels with the polio story. I mentioned the outbreak in 1916. That was the really big, bad one. It was also the very first time that polio, if you like, really declared its hand. And as you mentioned in the introduction, there were little outbreaks in the years before that. It was described sort of at the end of the century previously. But most of these outbreaks were small scale, and they just picked off a handful of kids and then melted away again. And for some reason we don't know, polio changed its nature at the beginning of the last century and became this huge epidemic monster. And it's unfortunate that its first big victim, if you like, was the East Coast of the U.S. and New York State during the summer of 1916.
All right. And this morning we have Dr. Gareth Williams with us, an emeritus professor of medicine at the University of Bristol. And we're talking about polio and how those epidemics worked, how we figured some things out about the disease and what we might be able to take away from it today. This conversation continues here on The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network. We're thinking about COVID-19 through the lens of another epidemic, polio. You're listening to The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina. Polio killed and paralyzed millions of children until a vaccine became widely available in 1954. And we're talking about why it took so long, and we're considering what's changed in public health strategy since. We're taking your calls at 800-642-1234, or you can email ideas@wpr.org. What do you want to know about polio? Dr. Gareth Williams wrote a book about the story of polio, and he's sharing his insights about that disease with us. And we had John from Mequon call, and he says his father grew up in Milwaukee, and his dad and uncle spent summers in Burlington during the polio outbreak. So John giving us an example of a family who tried to flee those tightly packed cities during polio season for sure. Dr. Williams, you have a personal connection to the search for a polio vaccine. What is that?
Well, I did, and I'd completely forgotten about this until I was most of the way through the book and talking about it with my mother. And she reminded me that when I was four, I was involved as a guinea pig in one of the very early clinical trials of a polio vaccine. And at the time, we lived in Belfast in Northern Ireland, and the professor in charge of infectious diseases at Queen's University was a friend of my parents. He'd been approached by a rather maverick scientist and vaccine person called Hilary Kaprosky, worked at a drug company in New York, to say that he had developed an early polio vaccine, which at the time was the first, came in before the Salk vaccine even, and would George Dick, this professor, like to try it out? So he nobbled my dad over lunch at Queen's and apparently asked him if he had any kids. And my father said, yes, I think so. And George Dick said, well, I've just put my daughters into this clinical trial. Can I have your kids for the same thing? And my dad said, yeah, carry on, do what you like. So he did, and it didn't mean very much to me at the time, except that I got to visit George Dick's lab. And it was an astonishing place and probably one of the things that made me want to do medicine, in fact. But the interesting thing about the trial was that none of us came to harm. It was a very early experimental vaccine, and it actually went wrong. And it turned out that this supposedly harmless live virus, which had been altered in Kaprosky's lab and was supposed not to cause paralysis, just induce immunity, actually had the effect, once it had been through the gut of children, in a small proportion of cases, actually turned into a virus that could actually paralyze experimental monkeys. So the outcome of that was that the man coordinating the trial in Belfast wrote a series of articles saying that the polio vaccine in its current state is not safe, and that he would need a lot of convincing with the safety of any polio vaccine. And that meant that even when the Salk vaccine had passed its test in the US, people in the UK were very, very slow to take it up because, if you like, the waters are still poisoned by this freak experience and the trial in Belfast.
Hmm. I love that you got halfway through the book writing it and then rediscovered this information that was so close to what you were working on.
Absolutely.
We've got Joanna in Monona on the phone ready to talk with us. Hi, Joanna.
Hi. First of all, I just want to remind people, Jerry Epp has written a book about his personal experience with polio called Limping Through Life. My aunt had polio, and she got it in the mid-50s when she was pregnant with my cousin. But she had a successful birth, and she went on to have two more kids. It affected the muscles in the back of her neck, so she could never hold her head upright. And if you were sitting down and she wanted to look you in the eye, she would have to put her hand under her chin. And I was in kindergarten in 1954. And I remember when they vaccinated everybody in the school and we got in these lines and waited to have our turn to get the shot. And while we were in line, we carefully looked at the faces of everybody coming out of the room who'd already had the shot to see what they look like.
Joanna, thank you for sharing those stories with us. Dr. Williams, what do we know about how polio affects a person's body? I mean, obviously, much of it is permanent, as Joanna's aunt shows us.
Well, that's a very interesting story from Joanna, and again, thank you for that. There are some wonderful photographs of kids waiting in line to be vaccinated, and Joanna's point about looking at the faces and the expressions is a very telling one indeed. What happened to her aunt is pretty typical, in that you're left with a degree of paralysis if you're unlucky. On the other side of the coin, most people who got polio either had a very mild illness or didn't know that they had anything wrong with them at all. And the lucky 95% basically got away with it. The unlucky 5% are the ones who had the virus getting into the nerve cells in the spinal cord that drive the muscles and left them with a degree of paralysis. There's a new problem for people who survived polio and might have had it 40 or 50 years ago. And this is a condition that's only recently been recognized. And in fact, many doctors still don't know that it is a true thing. And this is what's known as post-polio syndrome. And this is where, if you take the example of Joanna's aunt, she might not have been able to lift her chin, but she would have been able to do that by popping her hand underneath. Somebody with post-polio syndrome, or PPS, might actually then go on 40 years later to lose the strength in the arm that you'd used to push your chin up. So this is only now being recognized. And here in the UK, we have an association called the British Polio Fellowship. You've got very similar organizations in the US, and they're actually fighting for the rights of people, the long-term survivors of polio, to have this condition recognized and to make due allowance for it in society.
Dr. Gareth Williams is author of Paralyzed with Fear, The Story of Polio. And now we have Janet from Madison, who is ready to talk with us. Hi, Janet.
Hi. My mother had polio twice, once in the 30s and once in the 40s. And Dr. Salk told her that it was patients like her that struck fear in his heart, because they didn't know at the time if there were, you know, one strain of polio or 1,000, but because of her, they knew there were more than one in patients like her. Anyway, in the early 1950s, she drove my two older brothers to Ann Arbor, Michigan, 40 miles to have them take part in the vaccine trials. And my question for you is, what were my brothers doing? What were they getting in Ann Arbor with those vaccine trials?
Well, Janet, let's see if Dr. Williams can answer something of that question.
Well, the first thing to say is that Janet's mother illustrated a very important point, and it might have frightened Dr. Salk initially, but when Salk perfected his vaccine or developed it, it actually had representatives of all three strains of poliovirus in it, so that it would provide complete protection against any of the strains of polio. There are about 200 different strains, possibly more, but they all fall under three broad groups. We're called the types. Type 1 was the commonest, type 2 relatively less common, type 3 rather rare. So your mother would have had one of the other types, and then probably type 1, looking at the dates involved. As to her brothers, well, they would have been queuing up in Ann Arbor for the Salk vaccine. That was the first one to come through, the injectable one based on killed polioviruses. And as you know, the one by Albert Sabin, which was quite different, it was still polioviruses, but they were live and they'd been modified by putting them through unusual circumstances in the laboratory. And they were taken by mouth. So you have the injectable one, which goes into a muscle in the arm. That's the Salk one of dead or inactivated poliovirus. And then you have the drops, which in our day would have been put onto a sugar lump. Sugar lump now omitted because of the risk of dental caries. And this is what you see the very, very brave, courageous volunteers doing, particularly in Pakistan, Afghanistan, going around putting these pink drops into the mouths of the kids during the global vaccination campaign.
All right. Dr. Gareth Williams, I know we've just scratched the surface. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Dr. Gareth Williams is an emeritus professor of medicine at the University of Bristol, also wrote the book Paralyzed with Fear, The Story of Polio. I'm Keeley Boltina. The morning show continues just ahead. You're listening to the Ideas Network.